All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court for the first hearing in our September term. Today is September 9, 2024, and the matter before the court is John Doe 1 and Jane Doe 1 versus John Doe, case number 51723. In this matter, John and Jane Doe 1 appeal, represented by John E. Cutler and Kristen Escalante appearing only. For the respondent, John Doe, we have Christopher Meek as well as Weston Burke appearing only. Counsel, do either of you have anything for us preliminarily today?
No, Your Honor.
No. Very well, Mr. Cutler, you may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. On May 4th, 2022, the following factual findings and legal conclusions became concrete, incontestable facts and law between and among Respondent John Doe, 2024-2023, who I will refer to as Doe, and appellants Jane and John Doe 1, who I will refer to as parents, and their minor child. First, Doe failed to demonstrate a full commitment to the responsibilities of parenthood by providing any financial support. Second, Doe failed to take any responsibility for the minor child's future. Third, Doe waived and surrendered any right in relation to the minor child, including the right to notice of any judicial proceedings in the adoption of the minor child. Fourth, Doe's consent to the adoption was not required, either before or based on the new evidence provided as part of the motion to set aside the adoption judgment. And finally, the adoption occurred according to law. Going back as far as Marbury versus Madison, the supremacy...
Just a second.
Yes, sir.
You began your statement by saying these are final and uncontestable facts. The last one you mentioned, that the adoption procedures went forth pursuant to law, isn't that a question of law that's always going to be contestable?
Well, Your Honor, I indicated that these were final and conclusive factual findings and conclusions of law. So the law and the facts between parties can become settled and final, Your Honor. And that's the fundamental premise of our judicial system. In fact, it's the only purpose the judicial system exists is to have a forum in which issues of law between parties contested can become finally resolved and
but
decided.
But if that judgment is void, doesn't that call into question all of the other facts that you say are incontestable?
The issue of whether a judgment is void can become final and incontestable in the sense that if parties have an opportunity to litigate whether a judgment is void and they litigate that issue, or they elect not to pursue the issue in the forum and at the opportunity when they would be required to do so. The judgment that then says the adoption occurred according to law becomes final and conclusive, even as to that question of subject matter jurisdiction, even as the question is whether or not the underlying decision. So we have, just to break it down, we have two decisions in this case, Your Honor. The first is a judgment of adoption, that an adoption occurred and that a child has been adopted by the parents. The second is a claim contesting that judgment, moving to set it aside, asserting that the person who wasn't a participant, wasn't given notice, should have been given notice, had a legal right to be given notice, and didn't receive it, and therefore that adoption judgment should be set aside. That proceeding is the proceeding during which any question as to the validity or the voidness of the judgment is decided. And so in that proceeding, the motion to set aside the judgment, which includes participation by Doe, and an assertion that he should have received notice, and an assertion that the adoption should be set aside on the basis that he didn't receive notice, on the basis that all of these reasons, all the facts that were alleged, should provide a basis to set aside that judgment. When the court in that case decides, and this is a quoted, the adoption occurred according to law in that proceeding, that motion to set aside. And that judgment becomes final because the Doe did not perfect an appeal. That decision that the adoption occurred according to law is a final, incontestable legal conclusion between these two parties about these facts.
Isn't the issue not that it's final, but that it's reviewable?
It was subject to review during the period for appeal. It became not subject to review, and it became the law between the parties. Correct or incorrect, it's not that different than the case we were here before this court just a few months ago with respect to a decision that I understand, Justice Moore, you disagreed with. But the law in that case was that even though there may have been a mistake by the judgment is final. It is valid. It is not void because there was a decision and there was no appeal. Or in that case, the original decision was a default judgment. There was no right to contest the merits after that.
Well, I would argue Pinkham is distinguishable because the question in Pinkham was whether the facts established the judgment was void. So that's different. The issue here, as I see it, is can a party file more than one Rule 60B motion? That's what it strikes me the issue is, because if a party can file one 60B motion and then follow up with a 60B4, if that's permissible, and if the party establishes in the 60B4 motion that the judgment was void, that unwinds the judgment and that unwinds all of the factual findings that underlie the judgment. So isn't the real question we're faced with is, does a party get to file more than one 60B motion?
Your Honor, I think the question is a little bit narrower than that. And I think, because I think if you take it in the broad context of can a party in abstract file more than one 60B motion, the answer may be yes in certain situations. For example, if a party files one, later becomes aware of facts that were not known to it or something like that, and has a basis that could not have been raised for some reason, maybe there's a different factual scenario there. But the precise factual scenario in front of this Court today, Your Honor, is whether a party can file a motion to set aside, invoking both 60B3 and 4 in their papers.
But isn't that exception illusory, the 60B2 exception for new facts that you're discussing? Because that can only be brought within 6 months. Any 60B4 motion can be brought within a reasonable time, which could exceed 6 months.
Well, Your Honor, I think that if you've already filed, and we're talking about two different scenarios, Your Honor. One is, can you file a 60B4 after having filed another Rule 60 motion? That's different from what you're saying, Your Honor. I think the six-month time frame might be you could file a 60B motion on day one of the judgment and then discover a new fact and perhaps still be within the six-month time frame. So there's nothing illusory in the rules.
Right. So, I mean, you have to file a 60B4 first and then the 60B2, provided it's within 6 months.
Under this course,
then your hypothetical would work.
Under the foundational law of claim preclusion, a party must assert all of the claims, all of the grounds, legal arguments, factual arguments, everything that they have in one proceeding. They do not get to file and affirmatively say on the record, we're not here to say that this law is unconstitutional, which is what counsel in this case said, prior counsel for Doe.
And that statement was made before this Court's decision in Doe that talked about the biology plus test.
It was, Your Honor, this Court's decision in Doe broke no new ground. As we've cited in our papers.
For Idaho, it did. In terms of its application to Idaho statutes pertaining to adoption and termination of parental rights, it was the first time that this Court held that in a biology plus situation, it's unconstitutional to require the father to first file with the putative father registry and satisfy the other requirements. And that was in a situation where the adoption concerned a child less than 6 months.
Your Honor, going back to the 1980s, we cited in our papers the series of cases from this Court citing the same underlying U.S. Supreme Court decisions and applying the legal principles in those decisions to Idaho law going back decades before this Court's decision in Doe. Second, the parties in Doe obviously were aware of the legal issue from the U.S. Supreme Court, and they presented that to this Court, leading to this Court issuing its decision applying that law to a particular statute. So the law at issue is not new.
But and so let me delve into a different part of your argument then. I mean, we've typically reviewed the 60B grounds as separate and distinct from each other. And so where we have 60B2 that talks about new information, new evidence, new facts, and that's distinct from 60B4, which is the judgment is void and subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time. I'm struggling with why 60B4 can only be raised within a reasonable time after the discovery of new facts.
I'm not saying, that's not what my argument is, Your Honor. My argument is that if you assert a 60B motion of any kind, in that motion, you have an obligation under the doctrine of claim preclusion, not to split things up, but to bring every claim that you are entitled to bring at that time.
And this Court has not typically applied res judicata principles to 60B motions.
The Court has. If we look at State versus Wolf, this is in the criminal law context, but it's in the same type of motion. The Court has absolutely said that, yes, you could technically file a motion, but the outcome of that motion will turn, in part, on claim preclusion principles. And this
it's based on you can't file two post-judgment motions attacking the conviction on the same grounds. You get to make the argument once. You don't get to make it twice. Isn't that what State v. Wolf stands for?
No, State v. Wolf is much broader than that, Your Honor. The decision specifically says that a valid final judgment, this is at page 505 or 63, a valid final judgment rendered in an action extinguishes all claims arising out of the same transaction and series of transactions out of which the cause of action arose. Therefore, res judicata's preclusive effect bars not only subsequent relitigation of the claim previously asserted, but also subsequent relitigation of any claims relating to the same cause of action which were actually made or which might have been made in the first suit. And it goes on to say the United States Supreme Court has applied the doctrine of res judicata to subject matter jurisdiction claims.
Except later in the decision at page 506, the Court says we agreed with the Third Circuit's rationale and held that res judicata could be applied to bar successive Rule 35 motions where the defendant attempts to relitigate issues already decided in earlier Rule 35 motions.
And that conclusion is the finality of the analysis that preceded in which they say that even if you didn't raise these precise legal argument, the claim, the factual circumstances, the transaction has been adjudicated, and you cannot relitigate that transaction. That's what that conclusion follows, is
then
the analysis. Go ahead.
Sorry. Then how could you, taking your reading of Wolf, how could you ever file separate Rule 35 motions in the same criminal case attacking the legality of the conviction?
You would have
the sentence.
You would have to be able to establish that your new argument, your new claim, does not arise out of the same transaction or occurrence.
How could that be? Right. How could that possibly be in a criminal case?
That's a fair question, but that's the law. And I guess I am very hard-pressed to see how a legal decision to the contrary that allows a party to affirmatively decline to assert an argument that it was available to them, lose, decline to appeal that decision, and then decline to participate in writ proceedings before this Court.
Okay,
only
so
thereafter.
So, hold on. When you say decline to participate in proceedings before this Court, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to the prior writ of prohibition proceedings that were here, where there was notice given to Doe, and Doe elected not to intervene or to seek to participate in
and
those proceedings.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because your language, decline to participate, troubles me.
Okay.
The record reveals there were two notices of appeal filed. One filed in this Court, one filed in the District Court. However, the one filed in the District Court did not properly perfect the appeal because it was captioned for this Court. So to say he declined to appeal, I think the record at least raises a question. He wanted to appeal. Somebody failed to properly perfect it. And so I'm concerned that you have repeatedly represented in your briefing that he specifically declined. At points you say he chose not to appeal, and I just don't think the record supports that. At most, I think the record supports an inference that his attorney failed to properly perfect it.
I think that's incorrect, Your Honor. And I think the reason it's incorrect is the two notices of appeal that were filed were identical. Both went to the – every notice of appeal is filed in the district court. And it has to direct the appeal to another court. In this case, both of the notices of appeal that were filed were identical, word for word identical. And this court recognized both notices of appeal as being before it.
And the record indicates that after this court said we aren't going to hear it, that his counsel called the district court and asked for a hearing to be scheduled.
Your Honor, that's not admissible information because that was never in any declaration before any court or tribunal. The statement that you're referring to is a statement in a brief by counsel. There's absolutely zero evidence in this court that this court could rely on for any finding for purposes of this appeal that there was any contact to the district court.
And I'm suggesting there's zero evidence in the record to suggest he consciously chose, opted, told his attorney, I don't want to appeal, and then changed his mind and decided to file a second Rule 60B.
Your Honor, there may be no evidence as to the communications between counsel, but the record reflects that this court's decisions were clear that both notices of appeal were before this court and that they were denied and dismissed because it was in the wrong court. And no additional appeal was filed.
But how do you – if an appeal has been filed in the wrong court, how do you conclude that he intentionally waived or intentionally decided not to pursue that appeal? I mean, to Justice Zahn's point, the only inference is somebody messed up.
It's, I guess, what happened after the dismissal. You have time to perfect an appeal. None was filed. And then, I guess, the inference is added upon when you receive notice, when the district court sua sponte initiates proceedings, and the parents initiate a writ proceeding in front of this court because we did not believe that those sua sponte proceedings were appropriate. There's notice given to Doe of the writ proceeding before this court. And there's nothing by Doe filed in this court to participate.
And my point is you don't know why. And so to say that he chose to withdraw and drop the appeal and not pursue it, I just don't know how you – I understand as an advocate that's you, the inference you're drawing. But to say in the face of my questioning that, no, the record shows that, I'm not with you. I think there's a question. There's an unanswered question about why. Why didn't anything further get filed
and Your Honor,
in the district court?
I think we strongly disagree because the law of agency governs. This court has said on countless occasions that parties are responsible for their actions of their attorneys are their actions.
And the law of agency is different than saying he made a decision not to pursue the appeal.
Well, and especially because I mean, when we talk about Rule 60B, we're in the land of equity. And I mean, it seems to me that if we're talking about equitable principles, I question to what extent you're going to bind the principal to the agent's actions in the same way that you would in a legal context. I mean, it just, I think we've got to be really careful about what we're talking about. Equitable relief is an entirely different realm than the type of argument that you're advancing here.
Your Honor, there has been absolutely zero equitable argument made that there was a failure by counsel to do their job.
That's what Rule 60B is.
That's not what was alleged in this Rule 60B. There was no falling on the sword by counsel. There was no, I've made up, I messed up, and here's the why you should relieve me. You will not find any of that in this record. There is not one shred of admissible evidence to suggest that this was a screw-up by counsel. That's one of my critical foundational points in response to this line of argument. You would expect to see an affidavit from an attorney, you would expect to see that to be the premise of the second Rule 60B motion. The second Rule 60B motion doesn't even acknowledge the first Rule 60B motion.
Because the second, and I understand you argue to the contrary, the second Rule 60B motion was on different grounds. It wasn't on 60B1. It was on 60B4.
Your Honor, I don't think it matters which grounds it's on, because you have the opportunity to assert it. In what universe is it appropriate for a party to get to pick, and consciously pick, because you cannot just disregard the statements of counsel on the record to the magistrate court the first time around. And the statement on the record to the magistrate court the first time around was, we are, and I want to quote it because it's critical. The statement on the record, transcript record 6, page 23 of this transcript, starting at line 19, in the middle of the line. There has been Supreme Court cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court on the putative filer registry and it has been upheld. We all know that. All three of the attorneys in this room know that. And we're not filing to suggest this is unconstitutional. You cannot, it will fundamentally destroy the rule of law if this court says a party can stand up through their attorney and say, we are not filing to suggest this is unconstitutional. Get a bad decision that the doctrine judgment occurred according to law, according to, you know, the perception of the party who's raising the 60B motion. You get an adverse decision that the adoption did occur according to law. And thereafter, after saying, we're not filing to suggest this is unconstitutional, come back after not taking an appeal, for whatever reason, the rationale for not taking the appeal does not matter. It was not perfected. You cannot fail to appeal that judgment against you. When the question on the line is, did the adoption occur according to law, and you, and thereafter bring a motion to say it is actually unconstitutional.
So that first 60B3B6 motion was based on fraud. If that had been appealed, how would that have resolved the constitutional issues? It wouldn't, would it?
It would, Your Honor, in the same way that this Court's decision just 2 months ago in Sligo resolved the issue of an accounting. Because no one had actually asserted or performed an accounting, and nonetheless, even a stipulated dismissal that isn't a decision on the merits resolved the issue of the accounting. Because that claim went final, and it bars all other claims that could have been raised at that time. And there's no question, I don't think anyone on this Court could say that there's any question that an assertion that the statute was unconstitutional could have been brought in this motion. In fact, we know that it could have because a party did challenge it in Doe.
Except the distinction, Mr. Cutler, is Sligo involved the filing of a second suit. We don't have a second suit here. We're arguing about the filing of a second Rule 60B motion. The whole point is that the Rule 60B motion is in the same proceeding, and it is seeking to set aside the judgment that you're alleging provides the finality. And so part of the issue with your argument, from my perspective, in applying res judicata here, is we're in a circle. You can't move to set aside the judgment because we already have a judgment. The question, I think, has to be, can he file a second Rule 60B motion? And you may have arguments that, no, in this situation he can't because he should have addressed it in his first motion. I don't think that's a res judicata argument.
Well, let's look at what the elements of claim preclusion are under this Court's case law. Nowhere in the elements is the existence of an additional lawsuit. And if you look at all the way back, almost 75 years from this Court's decision in the H.S. and Kramer case, you have the same types of issues coming up in terms of whether a 60B motion, you could follow it up with a collateral action. But going to Sligo, this Court said the elements of claim preclusion are, one, the original action ended in a final judgment on the merits. Two, the present claim involves the same parties as the original action. And three, the present claim arises out of the same transaction or series of transactions.
Counsel, you're leaving out
action.
Some preliminary language from that paragraph. At the beginning of the paragraph, we said, under this doctrine, a claim is precluded if it could have been brought in a previous action. Isn't that what we're talking about, whether or not this is the previous action or the same action?
No, the question is, if it could have been brought in a previous action. Again, we're not talking about, it doesn't say a previous lawsuit, separate case number, in a previous action. A claim, and here's a critical component. A Rule 60b-4 claim that a judgment is void can be pursued in two ways. One, by moving to set aside the judgment within the same case number. Or two, by filing a new lawsuit.
Are you suggesting that an action and a lawsuit are not synonymous, that an action means something else?
That's correct. An action is any proceeding that results, that can result in order to establish preclusion, does result in a final judgment.
So you're saying then a motion is an action?
If it results in a final judgment, absolutely. If you have a 54B certificate of finality on something and someone didn't appeal it.
Do you have some authority for that view?
Every piece of authority that this court has issued makes no legal distinction as to whether it has to be in a separate case number or not. And critically, let's go to the purposes of the three purposes of claim
preclusion. Before you do that, what cases do you have that apply res judicata type principles in the same case other than the criminal case, the Wolf case, which is a Rule 35, not a 60B motion? They're different.
And I believe the H&S Kramer case does deal with that situation. It deals with the situation of whether or not you can fail to take an appeal and then
file a separate action.
It specifically says, Your Honor, that your only recourse if you choose to move to set aside and lose is to take an appeal. That's what it says. It does not say that you have, it says, an immediate available remedy, this is at page 431, to correct any errors and did not take advantage of such proper reviewing procedure. So what?
Right, but the motion in H.R. Kramer was seeking to dismiss the subsequent suit.
Your Honor, when a court like this makes a legal decision, I get that it's the inverse in that situation. But the court sets forth a principle of law that has to apply to both sides of that pencil. If I dismiss somebody's lawsuit that they filed subsequently because, and say in that context of that decision, that what you needed to do was take an appeal in order to address the issues that happened there, that statement of law is directed to guide the parties in subsequent cases. And it is binding on both sides of the pencil. You can't say because this issue, when I'm resolving issue A, if I say, you did it wrong here, you should have done it this way. And then somebody comes before the court and says, look, you've said here that here's the way you have to do it, and that's your only way. We can't just say, oh, well, because it involves a factually distinct context, that makes a legal difference. There's zero legal difference, and I would challenge anyone on this court to come up with a legal explanation, a rationale policy-wise, and this is where I want to get back to the fundamental principles of claim preclusion, and what are the purposes behind that doctrine? Because they absolutely apply in this context. If this court rules against my clients, it would be ruling against every principle that is at the foundation of the claim preclusion doctrine.
Mr. Cutler, I guess my response to that, and I'd like you to let me know your thoughts on this. The competing interest is the interest of due process, the interest that somebody receive notice. And our case law also long holds that without due process, the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, to enter a judgment. So I absolutely understand we do have very strong interests on the side of the equation that you're arguing, but there are interests on the other side of the equation, which are if somebody can show I was entitled to notice and an opportunity to respond and I didn't get it, set aside the judgment, give me an opportunity to appear and provide my argument, that's also a very strong competing interest because we're talking about the very jurisdiction of the court to enter the order in judgment in the first place.
Your Honor, that rationale does not exist here because of the first Rule 60B motion. What more process could there be, or would there have been, than to be in front of the court with every one of the same affidavits that are now on this second motion? what the magistrate court found to be the identical factual record, the opportunity to assert that due process claim right then and there. And there is absolutely, I don't think there's any basis. This law has been on the books for decades when it comes to the federal constitutional rights that this court enforced in Doe. They are federal constitutional rights that have been in existence since the 70s and 80s and that were the premise for the parties bringing the case under Doe. That same motion, that same argument existed legally. The facts were all put to the court in that first motion. That's a full opportunity to be heard. And the party presented all that information and affirmatively walks away, decided. Again, and this court has to bind the parties as to their counsel's representations to the court. Otherwise, the system will not function. If parties can simply walk away from their counsel's statements on the record to the court that they are choosing, not whether through picking a bad attorney or otherwise, the attorney before this court binding that agent says we are not pursuing a constitutional argument with all the facts behind them to make that argument. With all the law.
I guess my struggle with your argument, Mr. Cutler, in part, is I'm thinking about if we adopted that argument, how would it apply in criminal cases, for example, where the United States Supreme Court comes down, announces a new rule, sentencing, death penalty sentencing, under your argument, because all the pieces were there legally and somebody else didn't put them together, now a defendant who was sentenced to death by a judge cannot come back in the face of a new U.S. Supreme Court decision that says you have to be sentenced to death by a jury. They're precluded from coming back and making that argument. I struggle with that because I think as new constitutional rules, principles are adopted, parties have the ability, if they can satisfy the reasonable time requirement of 60B4, to come in and say, this rule should apply to my case, too.
Your Honor, two responses.
Your Honor, I would just interject to say you're out of time, but I will allow you to answer this question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two responses, Your Honor. First, is that even in the criminal context, there are numerous times where the courts have said that new rulings don't change the finality of prior judgments. Second, even in this case, this court's decision in Doe was as to a totally separate side of the statute, not the one that applied in this case. And so even there, there's going to have to be, and in fact, counsel has made the argument that we're asking to extend. So there hasn't been any new decision from this court that triggered something new here, other than an additional ground to argue that a separate section, an analysis should apply. And so neither of those grounds should change this court's decision. There was a due process opportunity to be heard. An appeal wasn't taken from the adverse decision. None of that can be overlooked in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, Justices Zahn, Brody, Chief Justice Bevin, Justice Mueller. My pleasure to be in front of you for the first time, Justice Meyer. Also, I'd just like to thank also Mr. Cutler, Ms. Escalante, and my co-counsel, Mr. Burke, for being here today. I'm Christopher Meek. As you may know, I represent the biological father, the respondent in this appeal. At its essence, as has been identified by Justice Zahn, this case really is about the question of whether or not a successive Rule 60B motion should be allowed by this court.
And don't we have serious finality concerns, as the appellant has indicated? I mean, even if we don't agree that it's res judicata principles, aren't principles of finality at play here? And why should we allow this in the face of an argument that statements by counsel that the constitutional question is not at issue? We allow waiver of constitutional claims. We do it all the time, even in the context of parental rights. Even in the context of parental rights, we allow waiver. And if that's the case, then why does your client get another bite at this apple?
Great.
He had tried to appeal, and setting aside issues about why, the appeal wasn't perfected.
There's a lot to unpack in that, Your Honor, and so I'll try and do my best. First and foremost, Rule 60B does not say anywhere in the rule that I can identify that you only have one chance to file a Rule 60B motion. There is no case in this state that I have been able to identify that has been briefed that stands for that proposition. Certainly, I recognize the Washburn case. It's a 1951 case, pre-rules of civil procedure that this court adopted in 58 or 59, that in a glancing comment makes the comment about this right to appeal directly or a right to file a motion. It doesn't say you can't file another motion. It doesn't say that. So preliminarily, from a rights standpoint as a litigant, just like rights to summary judgment, motions to file summary judgment, we file multiple motions to file summary judgment. We file multiple motions to dismiss a case. We can file multiple motions to amend our pleadings. All of these deal with claims you raise in a case to resolve the issue on its merits, which is the whole point of litigation. Is to determine folks' rights as a matter of finality on the merits. There's not a single action that has been filed in this case that has gotten to the merits of my client's rights, which is, to put it plainly, my client, an undisputed biological father, exercised unsupervised visitation with his client all the time, over multiple times a week, for the first 9 months of a child's life. 9 months. And then had his parental rights terminated with absolutely no notice. He walks over to the house the next day and mom says, get out of here. You're done. And we have a motion that's filed. A motion based on fraud. And certainly I recognize that that led to an appeal and that appeal was dismissed. Today I get the ability to honor my former partner, Tim Hopkins, who had told me as a young attorney that when you have a failed appeal, it is jurisdictional, meaning it's as if no appeal was ever done. This case, and something fundamental to this case, is this concept. When that appeal failed, it's as if it never left the magistrate court. This court didn't take jurisdiction of it. The district court didn't take jurisdiction of it. So it remained in the magistrate court. If that's the case, there never was an appeal. There never was any legitimacy to the appeal. And it's as if one was never filed. So the finality is there. I don't deny the fact that there's been a final judgment. That's the whole premise upon which the second Rule 60B is based. And so then the question of finality comes into the context of a Rule 60B-4 analysis. Is it a timely motion? Because that is the threshold, in my mind, of finality. If we have those time frames in place, is that not the final decision as to whether or not that decision can be reviewed on grounds of law, as to whether or not someone's rights have been violated, or whether fraud took place, or whether there's new facts, or whatever? That rule has set for specific grounds of time that allow you to challenge that judgment.
And the language in the rule isn't timely. It's a reasonable time, correct?
As to Rule 60B-4, it is, which to me makes it a special portion of the rule. Why? Because they didn't say 6 months. They didn't give a specific time frame. There's the case that it's 20 years. Okay, well, 20 years is too long, but we're not presumptively saying it's too long because we don't really know. There's certain factual circumstances that could exist that would necessitate that. In this case, reasonable time for a father's rights, which we give to some degree in the law. I mean, we have different standards of review. This is a personal right to raise your child. It is a constitutional right. It's not just a litigation right. And because of that, it's given heightened scrutiny.
I think that's a good argument if you look at it from the father's perspective, why the reasonable time might extend. But let's look at it from the other party's perspective for just a second, especially the child's perspective. You know, this was an adoption proceeding, and I'm not going to get into the merits of whether it was handled right or not, but isn't there some interest on behalf of the adoptive parents and especially of the adoptive child that these matters be pursued as quickly as possible, and that there'd be no unnecessary delay because it results in a child being placed in a home and later taken away? after they've bonded and after they've acclimated themselves to the new environment? I would suggest that would maybe lead to a reading of reasonable under an adoption circumstance at a little shorter period of time than maybe in another circumstance.
Yes, thank you. It's a great question, but it really leads to kind of two parts of the analysis. The first part being that in an adoption proceeding, of course, you have certain rights that are applied, and as you mentioned, you know, in my instance, in this case, they weren't applied. So do we let a fundamental error of law continue? Do we let a father who wasn't given notice to be completely removed forever from this child? This is not a piece of dirt. This is not money. This is a human life. And to say that the child has normalized to the circumstances because 7 months have followed about that from the time of the adoption to the time of the second motion filing, that now she just, her right to her interest to the father is not as important now because she's normalized in the circumstances she's in. Let's not forget that 7 months prior to that, she was ripped from the ability to be around her father altogether by no choice of her own. And fundamental to it as well is we're not talking about an adoption proceeding that's a blind adoption that occurs often in cases like this where you have a parent who terminates their rights, father who often isn't involved, putative father registry, etc., and then an adoptive family that adopts the child in a completely different scenario than what they grew up in. In this instance, and it's important, I think, to look at that Rule 60b-4 and the concept you're saying in the context of the facts of the case that we have in front of us. And the facts of the case in front of us are simple. Even if my client is meritorious, even if at the end of this litigation my client were to have time with his daughter, there's nothing in this case that says that mother will not continue to have custodial time. Nothing.
Well, Mr. Meek, it strikes me that the court never made a finding one way or another whether your motion was filed within a reasonable time. And as I look at the case law, that's a factual finding, whether it was filed within a reasonable time. So we would have to remand it for that determination, whether the motion was filed within a reasonable time, wouldn't we?
Yes. That I don't like to answer it that way, but that is the correct answer, and we all know it. And that is something that will continue to lead to protracted litigation in this case, if that were the case. And I understand that. But that should not abrogate what happened here. What happened here is just wrong. I don't think any of us in the same situation as my client would say that what happened in this case was okay. It violates every thought in our minds and in our hearts that through a legal process, a parent could be able to be removed from their child without ever having notice, without ever having the right to present. It's in the record, the photos, the many affidavits, declarations that were filed.
Do we have the underlying adoption proceeding record for us? I've seen the transcript of the hearings that took place later on the motions that you filed. But do we know what was said in court on the day the adoption took place? What representations were made to the judge? Why he signed off on this adoption?
You know, I can't say that I can cite to the record on that, but my experience in that matter would say it probably wouldn't matter. And the reason why is they don't get into concepts in terms of termination when we're doing an adoption. We sit the family in front of us. We say, is everything in accord? Do we have all the record? Has the rights been terminated? Yes. Okay, let's proceed with this adoption. Do you love the kid? Are you going to support him? Do you have the ability to do so? Okay, great, grant.
Well,
we're done.
I don't know about that. I mean, I participate in a lot of adoptions as an attorney and a lot of terminations involved in those adoptions. And my experience with judges are typically, maybe not always, but typically very attentive to the issue of the termination and usually ask questions on the record of the parties petitioning for the adoption. I would have found their answers interesting in this case, and we don't have those.
And I agree with that in the context of an adoption where the termination takes place, as it often does, in front of another court or maybe in another state, sometimes in another country. In this instance, what we have is the same judge doing the adoption who did the termination hearing. Or the effective termination hearing. I don't want to really call it that because it wasn't my client standing in front of a judge, you know, being read 3.5 pages of questions and answering the questions saying, I'm hereby waiving my rights. That never happened in this case. It was just a procedural mechanism that led to him having his rights violated. And the question that is clear on the record from that first 60B hearing, and this is very interesting to me, is that the magistrate judge, Judge Husty, in this instance, did not ask the follow-up questions that are often asked by a judge in the context of a case like this, which I am now, by the way, based on the Doe decision, that's every judge I am in front of on termination cases asks those questions. The questions specifically are, did the father have any relationship with this child whatsoever? Did they have any contact with the child? Did they hold the child after the child was born? Have they paid a penny in support? Have they given any money, have they given any diapers, any in-kind donations whatsoever? Those are the questions that are required to be answered. And I can tell you in a couple cases I've had, I've answered in the affirmative, and in one specific case, and the judge says, I'm not doing this hearing. We're done. You're going to figure out how to resolve that issue before we move forward with this adoption case, because I'm not going to allow it to proceed. Because that's how important that fundamental right is to raise a child. That did not happen in this case. And to
In this case, it was essentially a procedural default, wasn't it? Because your client didn't do the putative father registry and hadn't filed a paternity action, that was the end of the story, wasn't it?
Well, if I can clarify by explaining my understanding of the adoption or the termination statute and the rights to notice statute, part of the adoption statute is what I should say. Under the rights to notice sections of the Idaho adoption statute, it clarifies two avenues for termination, or two avenues that you have to establish in order to determine whether a father has a right to notice of the hearing. The first avenue is a putative father who has not filed on the putative father registry and has not filed a petition to establish paternity. In that instance, if you establish both of those elements to the court, then the court can identify that the father has no rights pursuant to Idaho code because they haven't established any right to the child whatsoever by not doing those two elements. And in doing so, they have no right to a hearing. The second requirement or the second option under that statute to determine whether a notice is required is a question of whether or not a father has established a relationship with a child. Biology plus relationship. It's the Doe case, essentially. And under that section of the code, it specifically states that if you have that right to establish, some sort of support given to the child, then you are required by law to involve the father in the adoption case. You have to give him notice of the adoption, wherein the father can then step in, file his paternity case, notify the court of the paternity case, and then, you know, move forward with that court determining whether the adoption should go forward in, even though the father has established a right with the child or to the child. So those two aspects of it really clarify what happened in this case, which is, yes, the magistrate court held putative father, but truthfully, putative father didn't apply. Why? Biology plus relationship did. He had a relationship with his child. And this goes into the fraud claim, and we're not appealing that, but that was one of the fundamental parts of the claim on the fraud case was, well, they knew I had a relationship. They'd offered it to me. They baited me into all this. They'd said, I don't have to file on the putative father registry. They said I didn't need an attorney. And then I got hit with this thing where they told the judge that I didn't file on the putative father registry. It was a sucker punch. But the other part of that was, and what was not litigated, was my client saying to the court, wait, I had established a relationship here. Rule 60B4 applies. This is a void judgment because I wasn't given that notice that's required by a magistrate or should be required by the magistrate to tell me of that right before they take away my constitutional right. That's the fundamental issue of this case. And whether or not it's a timeliness issue of 6 or 7 months, to me, as Justice Zahn has identified, that's not an issue for this court. That's an issue for the magistrate. The only question,
Mr. Meek, can you address the prior counsel's argument in the first Rule 60B, saying I'm not challenging the constitutionality of the putative father registry, the fraud subsection 3 of Rule 60B is the one that I think is most relevant here.
Yeah, yes, I think if I'm understanding your question right, and to do this, I really just want to continue the reading by Mr. Cutler today, because I think it's a fundamental misreading of what he argued in front of the magistrate court. He said this is in the record, page 6 of the transcript, and I'm starting on that page, it's the transcript, so I'm starting on page 23, specifically line 16, and this is prior counsel in this case. Your Honor, the putative father registry and the sum of what draconian nature in which it operates has a purpose. And the legislature looked at that purpose. And there has been Supreme Court cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court on the putative father registry, and it has been upheld. We all know that. All three of us attorneys in this room know that. And we're not filing to suggest this is unconstitutional. It has already been proven to be constitutional. However, there's a back end around it. There are two back ends around it. Number, subsection 3 is one back end around it, and fraud. Actually, there are more than just fraud under 60B, as the court knows. The fraud, subsection 3 of Rule 60B, is the one that I think is most relevant here, but also subsection 6, and any other reason justifying release from the operation of laws available for this court. In the context of that waiver argument that's been argued multiple times, in the context of the constitutional right argument that's been argued multiple times, the only time in the record that's it's ever mentioned by prior counsel is in the context of 60B and specifically the putative father registry. We can see today the putative father registry is constitutional. Fine. But that doesn't mean he waived any right to claim under 60B4 that he wasn't given notice because he had constitutional right to the kid because of biology and a relationship.
But aren't those two arguments intertwined? Because to say the putative father registry is constitutional, necessarily, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's constitutional when you don't meet the biology plus test. And so in this instance, aren't you essentially arguing because he meets the biology plus test, he didn't have to register with the putative father registry to be entitled to notice prior to termination of his parental rights?
Absolutely. As a matter of law. That is the law in Idaho. It's clear that that's the law in Idaho. If you have established that relationship, then they have to give you notice.